Welcome to the Expert Series, brought to you by the Lupus Foundation of America. Our health education team is here to bring you accurate, relevant information to help you live better. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. My name is Melissa, and I'll be your host. I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Brad Rovin, who will be answering our questions about lupus and the kidneys. Dr. Rovin is the director of the Division of Nephrology at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center and a member of our Medical and Scientific Advisory Council at the Lupus Foundation of America. He specializes in treating autoimmune kidney disease. We're delighted to have you join us today, Dr. Rovin.
Thanks, Melissa. It's my pleasure to be here and talk about kidneys, which I love to do.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So this is our March episode of the Expert Series. So we're talking about the kidneys. March is Kidney Month, and March 14th is World Kidney Day. Most people probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about their kidneys. But if you have lupus, you need to think about your kidneys. So I want to start just with the basics. We can see that kidneys are so important to our health that they get their own day and their own month. So what do our kidneys do for us, and why are they so important to our overall health?
They are. And yes, we are coming up on World Kidney Day, which we'll celebrate at the World Congress of Nephrology coming up as well. So the kidneys are really have a lot of functions in the body. What most people probably know about the kidneys is that they filter the blood and make urine. And in that process of filtering the blood, the kidneys are very selectively getting rid of metabolic toxins. So things that occur during our normal process of living every day, the cells metabolize and create toxic substances, and we have to get rid of those. And the kidney does that. In addition to that, the kidney is very important in regulating a lot of the ions that we have in our bloodstream. So, for example, sodium and potassium, they have to be kept in very tight levels so that we function normally. The same with calcium and phosphate. So this is really important. In addition, the kidneys are master regulators of our internal volume. So when you get dehydrated, for example, if you're working out and it's a hot environment, the kidneys tend to retain fluid. Or if you get overhydrated, the kidneys tend to get rid of fluid. So the kidneys help in keeping our bodies stable within a very confined range of volume. So again, we can function normally. And even besides that, the kidneys are important as, for example, an endocrine organ, because the kidneys make hormones. And one of the hormones that the kidney makes is erythropoietin, which is really important in helping us maintain our red blood cell mass. So you can see it's a very, I call it a talented organ. Mm-hmm. My background is engineering. When I was in undergrad school, I sort of think of the kidney as the master chemical engineer of the body.
Wow. So I'll be honest, I didn't actually know that kidneys did all of that. I knew about filtering the blood, but I didn't realize all of that. It sounds, yes, kidneys are definitely a workhorse for us. And so for people with lupus, right, they have to think about their kidney health because of the risk of lupus nephritis and kidney disease. So I want to walk through the stages of kidney dysfunction and what the effects are and how it's treated. So for lupus and other autoimmune diseases, I believe that inflammation is the issue. That's really what damages the kidneys. So is that the case? And can you talk about how inflammation does begin to damage the kidneys?
Yeah, that's exactly the way I think about it as well. So in lupus, we'll use lupus as sort of the main example. It's the prototypical autoimmune immune complex disease. And when we say immune complexes, I think as most of our listeners probably realize, the body in lupus is generating antibodies. And we know antibodies because we make antibodies to fight infection and things like that. But in lupus, we can create antibodies against self proteins. So the antibodies start to recognize our own proteins. And when the antibody and the protein come together, they make immune complexes. Because the kidney filters the blood, the entire blood volume several times a day, the kidney is particularly subject to having these immune complexes interact with the filtering units of the kidney. And in fact, in lupus, these immune complexes can accumulate in the filtering units of the kidney. And just for for our listeners, the filtering units of the kidney are called the glomeruli. They are the first interaction where blood goes through this. It looks like a little ball of tiny blood vessels, and it goes through and comes out. But as it goes through, the pressure forces substances from the blood to go across into the kidney tubules that eventually become urine. And of course, you urinate that outside the body. And so these immune complexes can get stuck in various places within the filtering units of the kidney. And when they do that, by interacting with the kidney cells themselves and also interacting with the immune cells that are also in the blood floating through that those blood vessels, and also components of the immune system that are, for example, a host defense. They're important in maintaining our health in face of infection. These immune complexes can activate those substances. So very quickly, you can start to build up levels of inflammatory cells. So these are usually white blood cells and complement proteins. For example, complement is a system, again, a host defense system that helps protect us against infection, but does a lot of other things as well. And when these get out of control, you have frank inflammation in the kidney. Now, your question is very important. How can we tell early? And that's the real problem. And actually, it's a challenge that many of us are working on, is how to understand the very earliest stages of lupus nephritis. And I'm afraid we don't really know how to do that yet. When we get patients with lupus nephritis, it is already advanced in the sense that we realize it because patients have blood in their urine. Now, all of us excrete a few red blood cells in our urine. That's okay. Mm-hmm. That's normal. But they have blood in their urine that's more than normal, and they have protein in their urine. And then when we see that in the context of a patient with lupus, we know, or we can guess, that inflammation may be occurring in the kidney. But then we have to diagnose that, and almost all the time that's with a kidney biopsy. But what we're hitting is more advanced stages of the disease. And what we really want to do, and as I said, active research is being conducted, is go to the very earliest stages of disease and develop markers that we can follow that could suggest that the kidney is being hit by the autoantibodies or the immune complexes. And then could we intervene earlier for the patient to protect the kidney even better? That's my goal. In research we're doing.
Wow. So it is, it's a really complex process. And it sounds like from the point of view of the person with lupus, they're not going to get a lot of early signals that their kidneys are being compromised or are at risk.
Right. And that's so, when I'm sure we're going to we will talk about this, but I'll sort of upfront it. When a person with lupus, usually the blood in the urine with lupus, when the inflammation occurs and the filtering units are damaged, things that should be retained in the body leak across and come out in the urine. Okay, so that's what we look for right now. And we look for red blood cells, as I said, in larger amounts than a normal, a healthy person would have, and then increased amounts of protein. However, usually you don't have frank red urine suggesting blood, so you would have to look at the urine under a microscope to see the blood. It's called microscopic, so under the microscope, hematuria. And that means blood in the urine. And the same way with the protein, usually the levels of protein are well above healthy levels. We all excrete a little bit of protein in our urine as well, but they're well above healthy levels, but they may not be to the levels where it actually the patient recognizes there's a problem. However, sometimes that is the case, and the patient will come in to the physician's office and say, "Look, I'm swollen." And that should be a sign to the physician, obviously something is wrong. And when you lose a lot of protein in your urine, you can swell. But again, a lot of times the disease progresses silently until the person is, or the kidneys are in trouble.
Okay, and so that's then sort of moving along this, spectrum, this sort of journey as kidneys get more and more damaged. At what point? So it's that point when, people come in and maybe they're swollen, or you test their urine as part of a routine checkup, and you see those markers of too much protein, too many red blood cells, and that's the point where they're diagnosed as a as having lupus nephritis.
So lupus, yes and no. So yes, that's the general idea. Okay. Lupus nephritis is very specifically the immune complexes that I talked about earlier depositing in the kidney and causing inflammation. That's lupus nephritis. So when you see that in the kidney, with we examine the kidney tissue under the microscope, we in a patient with lupus, we call that consistent with lupus nephritis. Unfortunately, lupus, the disease lupus, systemic lupus, can damage the kidney in other ways. So those indicators can definitely be, and most often are, an indication of lupus nephritis, but there are other ways the kidney can be involved by lupus and injured by lupus that can also cause red blood cells or protein in the urine. But by far, the most common thing we see is lupus nephritis. To make the definitive diagnosis, which is what we always want to do before we treat, because these are not, these are treatments that are very often aggressive, if you'll allow me to use that word.
Sure.
We do want to do a kidney biopsy to have a verified diagnosis of what we're treating and how the kidneys look, and that's how we make the diagnosis.
Okay. And so you mentioned treatment, and so I want to ask that next. So if someone has, they've reached this threshold and you're aware that there's a problem, what treatments are you likely to prescribe? What's a course of action there for you and the patient?
So, there's a lot of different treatments available now. I will just say again to our listeners that we've made incredible progress in understanding the how this disease progresses, how this disease initiates. So that's sort of the pathogenesis of the disease, and we've made incredible strides in getting some medications approved for lupus nephritis. So what I do, and what most of my colleagues do, we will, once we have this idea that the person with lupus has blood and protein in the urine, we will do a kidney biopsy. We will look at how the lupus is affecting the kidney, and then we will design therapies, hopefully, as we progress with more and more targeted therapies specific for that individual. But in general, the approach is we need to decrease the inflammation, and we need to do that quickly. So almost everybody with lupus nephritis currently is treated with glucocorticoids, and I think I'll just use the word steroid because the listeners are probably most familiar with that. but usually prednisone. And this is prednisone is an excellent medication. There's no question about it. It can control inflammation very quickly, and help people. But it has a whole litany of side effects that are unpleasant, and they're short-term side effects that people don't like. For example, it can cause acne. It can cause people to become nervous and lose sleep. It makes you hungry. You eat more. You can gain weight. You can swell. Most people don't like that. And then it has longer-term side effects where you can have bone damage that becomes apparent later on. So that's what we have now. We're looking at other ways with drugs that are less, have less toxicity to control inflammation. So that's immediate. And then we have to control the autoimmunity part. So autoimmunity is why is the person with lupus getting lupus? Because they have developed autoimmunity, and there's an environmental component to that, and almost certainly we know a genetic component, which we're trying to figure out as well. But it isn't like one gene. It's multiple genes that all sort of gang up in the right stimulus, autoimmunity is initiated. So we want to turn the immune system off. We want to turn off the overactive immune system and stop the production of antibodies against our self proteins. And for that, we use drugs that I call immunosuppressive drugs. I think a lot of patients hear the word chemotherapy because we have borrowed a lot of these drugs from the oncology world. And they are used sometimes as chemotherapy for cancers. Obviously, in this situation, we're not treating cancer, but we want to change how the immune system is operating. So they're immunosuppressive drugs. And nowadays, there's sort of what we've been using for a long time, and then we've had two new drugs approved in the last 2 years. And I would suggest to you that given the clinical trial landscape, we'll have more drugs in the next couple years as well.
So that's great to hear. I know there is a lot of exciting research going on, and I'm glad you brought up steroids. I've heard other rheumatologists say that they have a love-hate relationship with steroids. I think that people with lupus also might characterize, their feelings about steroids in the same way, and that, it's an absolutely vital part of treating lupus, but also, it has all of these other, this other side to it, a dark side, as it were, that can make it difficult.
You're spot on. One of my slides in one of my talks is called "Our Love." The title is "Our Love-Hate Relationship with Steroids." So, and we didn't rehearse this, right?
No, we did not. But yeah, I think that it's a pretty common feeling. I think that with all of the research that's going on, people would really like to be able to break up with steroids if possible in the future.
Yes.
With all of these treatments, though, I think that, sometimes the lupus nephritis, the damage does continue to progress to the point where people's kidneys just cease to function. And so, and that obviously, as you explained earlier, everything that kidneys do for us, that is very dire. So can you kind of walk us through what it means when you get to that level and when a person needs dialysis? And if you need dialysis, does that always lead to needing a kidney transplant?
So dialysis is our way of substituting for a kidney that's not functioning, kidneys that aren't functioning anymore. And when a person gets to that stage, and a person's not going to just usually show up that way. Hopefully a person with lupus will have been followed very carefully, and so the person's prepared for what would be inevitable if that's how their disease is going. And I will say that we're much better at preventing that now. So I don't want people just to, have worry about this because I think we can do a much better job. But if you get to the point where the kidney function is so reduced that it is not maintaining your homeostasis, that's the word we use, we keep the body in balance, so to speak. You know, the patient will notice that they're retaining fluid, for example. The patient will notice fatigue that is beyond what, and fatigue is a big component of lupus, I understand that, but beyond that, they'll potentially have loss of appetite, food will taste funny or metallic or yucky, and they can have nausea and vomiting, they can become itchy, and so those symptoms are consistent with what we call uremia, which means kidney failure. And so we will talk about kidney replacement therapy. And most of the time that starts out with dialysis. Dialysis can be done in two ways. We do the one that most people think about is on a machine several days a week for about 3 to 4 hours. And there's another form of dialysis that we like to encourage patients. They can do it at home. It's called peritoneal dialysis, where we actually use the membrane lining the abdominal cavity to do dialysis across. And we put a catheter in there and the patient infuses fluid and then takes the fluid out and flushes it down the toilet, that sort of thing. Your question is really important. Does this always lead to a kidney transplant? The ideal situation for a person who has come to require renal replacement therapy, and something all of us strive to do, is to get that person transplanted, because right now that is the most effective kidney replacement therapy to bring that person totally back to their normal lifestyle, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's not entirely normal because, of course, transplant requires people to take anti-rejection drugs, many of which are the same that we use to treat the lupus. They're immunosuppressive drugs. But that's our goal. And especially lupus affects people in general who are young and, you know, have a very long life ahead of them. And so we really push all of our lupus patients who come to what we term end-stage kidney disease or kidney failure to get a transplant. And I will say that as one is being followed in the clinic, if it becomes apparent that they are going to need kidney replacement therapy, I start the conversation early, because the best transplants, the ones that really last a long time, are living related donor transplants. So somebody that you're related to, brother, sister, parent, etc. And so we start to have the patient have this conversation with their family. Are there potential donors in the family? And I like to start early.
Yeah, that seems like it's a long conversation, you know, for people to have a lot of things to consider. So if that happens, if someone receives a kidney transplant, does that mean that they no longer have lupus nephritis? You mentioned that anti-rejection drugs, I believe that is then a lifelong therapy. But is that then sort of protective against this happening again?
Well, that's really a very interesting question. You opened up a can of worms. In my day, when I was younger, and people would go to end-stage kidney disease with lupus and then get transplanted, sort of the mantra was their lupus became quiet and seemed to remit. We know that's not 100% true. So we know that if a person does have kidney failure from lupus, a lot of times systemic lupus, so the other things that lupus can do, and as the listeners know, there's a lot, that does quiet down considerably. And in many of my patients who've been transplanted, they don't really when I see them, they don't seem to have any extra kidney symptoms of lupus. But you have to be on your guard because that's nothing in medicine is 100%. And so you can't just say, oh, I'll not even think about lupus flaring anymore in my patient. So I think the patients generally do better than one would have expected, and their disease seems quiet, but it can flare up. Now, for the question of lupus nephritis, so you're putting a brand new kidney in, and that kidney in general, of course, would be a healthy kidney. And then as we follow the patients along, they seldom, but they can, but seldom develop lupus nephritis again. It's very interesting. And you could say, well, they're on these medications lifelong. Yes, that could be one part of it, but of course they were on medications, similar medications indeed, when the kidney, was damaged. And is it also the environment? Something has changed. When you develop kidney failure, your body chemistries do change inevitably. Even with dialysis, we don't get back to everything being just like a healthy person. So does some of that play a role on the immune system and keep lupus quiet? I don't think we know the answers to that, but what I want people to come away with is this is a disease that does very well with a kidney transplant, and having lupus is not a reason not to do a kidney transplant. And in fact, we encourage people to have kidney transplants. So I think that's the really important message.
I think that is an important message and an important bottom line. And, I feel like for people who come into it and they've already been very sick, perhaps there is this feeling that a transplant would be too much for them. But I feel like what you're saying is that no, that that's a transplant. In fact, if you can get one, obviously kidneys, they can be in short supply, and I know that people do wait for them. But that a transplant really can be a life-changing opportunity for someone whose lupus nephritis or lupus is that severe.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. I every, knock on wood, I don't have that many people who've come to end stage kidney disease with their lupus, but I think every one of them, almost every one, we've gotten transplanted, and it's really that's our goal, 100%.
Okay, that's so as you said though, that not many people get there, and I think the goal is so that people don't ever actually need that level, that kidney replacement therapy. So recognizing that, and recognizing that lupus is unpredictable, it's hard to know how things are going to go, but are there ways that people can protect their kidneys and prevent or slow down kidney damage? What do you tell your patients to help them protect their kidneys?
Yeah, and that's really an excellent point because I think as patients are really engaged in their own self-care and understand their disease, they tend to do really much better. So one of the most important things is making sure blood pressure is under control. Any kidney disease, lupus nephritis included, in patients, if their blood pressure is not well controlled, this accelerates kidney damage and pushes them towards progression towards kidney failure. So, we really want meticulous blood pressure control, and the physician managing the blood pressure can use blood pressure medications that have a dual function. And when I say a dual function, they're controlling the blood pressure, but they're also kidney protective. And the ones that I think most of the listeners would be familiar with, if they have lupus and kidney diseases, they're on things called ACEs and ARBs. And these are the sort of shorthand name for antihypertensive medications that interact with a body system called the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. And it doesn't matter. These are hormones and growth factors, et cetera.
That's quite a word. That's quite a term.
Yes. So we call them RAS, renin-angiotensin, RAS inhibitors, RASI. So anyway, we use these because they actually control blood pressure, and they reduce pressure inside the filtering units of the kidney, and this helps the filtering units of the kidney maintain, okay, and they reduce protein in the urine. So these are all benefits to the kidney. So we call them kidney protective blood pressure medications. So that would be something that the patient should be looking at, and the patient should monitor their blood pressure at home, and their physician will give them guidelines as to where they want the blood pressure most of the time. So that's very important. And then other things that the person can do, of course, healthy lifestyle is important. Some of our patients, unfortunately, have lupus with diabetes, and having the diabetes under good control is really important because, as everyone knows, in the United States and most Western countries, diabetic kidney disease is the biggest form of kidney failure out there. So controlling other health conditions is really important. I think that people don't realize smoking can affect the kidneys. So I really encourage my patients, if they do smoke, to try and stop that. I also like my patients to consider weight loss if they're very overweight. And I know this can be hard, especially if you're taking steroids, but obesity can actually damage the kidney as well. So these are sort of lifestyle changes that people can do to try and help. And then, you know, diet, a lot of people approach me with all sorts of unusual diets. Is that going to help my kidneys? Are these anti-inflammatory diets, et cetera? The one thing we know about diet is that if you not to consume an excessive amount of protein, and, you know, I like to eat meat, so I'm a bad example, but, you know, and I'm not saying not to eat meat or things like that, but you talk with your physician, and often we have a dietitian work with the patient to keep the sort of total protein consumption reasonable, because too much protein can actually increase issues with the kidney. And of course, not enough protein can cause nutritional problems. So that's something that really needs to be worked out. The other thing is, and this also would help blood pressure and swelling, is to watch the amount of salt you take in. And this is really hard, because in the American diet, for example, or in, you know, foods that's available to us, sodium is in everything. And especially if you have blood pressure, you know, a lot of the very beneficial effects of blood pressure medications can be attenuated or even go away if you consume too much salt. And this is really hard, because by and large, you know, these are people with lupus and lupus nephritis are young people sort of in that part of their life where they're, you know, enjoying themselves and going out for pizza with their friends and that sort of thing. So this can be a little bit difficult, but those sort of lifestyle changes are really important, and they can help the person maintain kidney function for longer.
Yeah. So thank you for that list of things that can help. I know as you acknowledged, a lot of those things aren't easy, right? It's not necessarily easy to stop smoking or easy to lose weight or easy to figure out how much salt you're eating and cut back. But, you know, in the long run, would you say that even making like small gains in those areas is helpful to people, that it's worth it to kind of keep plugging away at it, even if they feel like they're not entirely successful all the time?
Yes, there's no question. And I'm very realistic with my patients, because, you know, let's say it's your birthday and your family wants to take you out and celebrate, and you go off the wagon, so to speak, and you have something, you go out for pizza or something, it's okay. You can't be 100%. You have to live your life. You have to enjoy things. And so I don't want people to beat themselves up and say, oh, geez, I made a mistake and now I've, everything's going to go away. Every little thing you do cumulatively will help. And yeah, it may not be perfect, but you're giving it a shot, and that's what really helps. And you'd be surprised. You lose a couple pounds, and if you have joint pain, for example, you can really relieve a lot of it with very small changes. You cut a little of the salt back, and your blood pressure is a lot easier to control. So it isn't an all or nothing sort of a proposal. You have to do it, or you're not going to get better. It's sort of a continuum, and the more the person does, the more comfortable they become. Actually, people, my patients become very educated. They know, they can go to the store and say, well, this has got too much salt in it. I will choose this. They become an educated consumer, and that's good for the rest of their lives.
So I think that is great advice, and I really appreciate you kind of reinforcing that to our listeners that it's a step by step, day by day, it's a journey, and you don't have to be perfect, but trying is really what counts. So my last question. You mentioned earlier that there have been a couple new treatments in the past couple of years, and there's a lot of research going on. So I just wanted to ask, are you hopeful for the future of treating lupus nephritis and lupus related kidney disease for your patients?
I am absolutely excited about the future of treatments for lupus nephritis. By a lot of the work that we have done, and when I say we, I mean the nephrology and rheumatology community over the last several years, bringing two drugs to FDA approval has stimulated so much work in the field that we have. I can't even count the number of clinical trials of novel therapeutics, and there's several that are wrapping up sort of the phase three trials, which often are used by the FDA for qualification of a medication, that are very, very exciting medications and really impact lupus nephritis in a positive way. And they have far less toxicity than the older regimens of generalized immunosuppression, where we sort of come in and, try to really turn off the entire immune system. What we're doing now is very targeted therapies where we look at parts of the immune system that are really important in lupus nephritis, and try to antagonize those parts specifically, providing the patient with fewer side effects, hopefully, and then better outcomes. What's really exciting to me and research that I'm participating in is as we develop more of these therapies that are available and approved, now, can we say, patient one, your lupus is looking like this, and this drug is really going to be, or this cocktail of drugs is going to be good for you. Patient two, your lupus looks different. And I think that's really an important point for listeners. Lupus is a very heterogeneous disease, and everybody's is a little bit different. It's not like everything is going to work for every single person. And so we want to be able to decide the best mix of treatments for your lupus. And I think we're not there yet, okay, but the work that's being done is really pushing us very rapidly in that direction. And to me, this is exactly what we need, is individualized, and you hear this all the time, personalized medicine, that sort of thing. But I think we're actually moving in that direction for the treatment of lupus and lupus nephritis now. And this is really fabulous. And something, when I started this a long time ago, I won't tell you how long, but a long time ago, I didn't know we were going to get to this point. And the first few clinical trials that I was involved in fact, every clinical trial I was involved in at the beginning failed. And I was sort of down in the dumps. And then we started really hitting on, mechanism and mechanistic ways to treat lupus. And it's like the door opened, and so I would be very optimistic for the future. I would encourage the listeners that if they do have lupus and they want to participate in moving this field forward in terms of treatments, if your doctor talks to you about clinical trials, consider them. I don't want you to go in there and think that, oh, they're doing experiments on me. We do them with the utmost safety, but the idea is moving treatments forward, and we've been successful. And if your doctor doesn't tell you about clinical trials, then you should be proactive and say, hey, I heard there's a lot of activity in the lupus nephritis field. I'd like to contribute to that. Where could I go for a clinical trial? And in most of the US, there is someone to connect with, networks where even the Lupus Foundation, of course, will help patients find clinical trials, and that's how we are going to beat this.
Yeah, absolutely. We at LFA are very happy to help people find clinical trials and to encourage people's participation. It is a very hopeful time. And the reason that it is such a hopeful time is because people have participated in the trials that led to the recent approvals and breakthroughs, and that are currently ongoing and that are going to lead to treatments in the future. So, I would absolutely encourage our listeners as well to think about participating in clinical research. It's how things happen. It's how we keep that hope going. So I want to thank you so much, Dr. Rovin, for your time today and for helping us understand how lupus affects the kidneys. I have learned so much from just talking with you, so I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
For those listening in, you can find more information on lupus from the National Resource Center on Lupus by visiting lupus.org/resources. To listen to additional episodes of the Expert Series, you can visit lupus.org/the Expert Series, where you can also subscribe to get alerts when podcasts are released. If you would like to connect with one of our health education specialists, you can go to lupus.org/healtheducator or call 1-800-558-0121. And finally, to connect with others with lupus from all over the world, I invite you to check out our online support community, Lupus Connect, where you can talk with others, find emotional support, and discuss practical insights for coping with the daily challenges of lupus. You can find the community at lupus.org/resources/lupusconnect. Thank you for listening.